I was a committer for a while, committing to the Sorcery for a few years. And basically, my paying gig took enough time out of my life that I couldn't really keep that up. But I never really left. I still am a FreeBSD user to a great extent. And KFU.com, and particularly the machine quack.kfu.com, has been a machine sitting in my house, my apartment first, that's been on the internet since 1993. I always knew, growing up, and the times that I got to visit the thing that was the internet back then, which of course was before there was like the World Wide Web and stuff, but back then it was IRC and FTP servers. I still wanted to sort of have a connection to that. It always had some great appeal to me. Going earlier back, I was a BBSer in a big way, so there's always sort of the idea of using these things we called computers as means of communications with other people has always held a great deal of interest for me. So, okay, fine. I've got a machine in my garage that's been serving as my mail server for all that many years. Why would I do this great experiment of moving it off onto hardware that doesn't really exist? Well, the problem is that if you're going to have a server, you need to have static IP addresses. Now, yes, you can do the dynamic DNS thing, and that mostly works. Of course, you still have to find a static IP'd DNS server for that, so you're going to have to at least get somebody to do that job for you. but generally, you know, whenever you're going to do the DNS thing, you're going to have limitations. You can't do HTTPS properly or reasonably. You're going to have a lag between the time that your server detects that its IP address has changed and the time that then DNS gets updated and propagates throughout the entire known universe, which means your DNS TTLs are going to be low, and that means that there's more traffic to your DNS server if you care. It's less than ideal. So I've always wanted to have, you know, a static IP'd server. So for all the time, at first I had dial-up static IP address. I was a customer of Barnet many years ago. But shifting forward a little bit more recently, I've been using DSL. And the DSL offerings, Comcast doesn't offer, in my neighborhood, Comcast is the cable modem provider, Comcast doesn't offer residential static IP address service. They offer commercial service, but it's priced at a much higher tier, and you can't do the bundling thing if you also get cable TV. And so it's less desirable from those perspectives. And if you're a residential cable modem customer, they really don't want you to be doing a whole lot on the uplink channel, right? Because that's constrained for cable modems. So as a DSL customer, you can go to AT&T, nay, Pac Bell, and get their DSL service that has a download of 6 megabits per second and an upload of 768 kilobits per second. Now, I don't know about you, but nowadays, that's a little tiny. And we've got, we have Vonage, and we have a microcell for our AT&T cell phones, and 768K ain't what it used to be. And so that was the last straw. Now we have Comcast's high tier for residential service, 50 megabits down, 10 megabits up. There's just, yes, it could get faster than that, but why? So that's just fine. Of course, it's dynamic IP addresses, but they don't change very often. So you can do the DynDNS thing to get back to your house from on the road, and that's not unreasonable. But you're not going to put any services there, and their terms of service don't let you have servers anyway. So that's just as well. All right. So before I contemplated moving off into the cloud, my server in the garage suffered yet another disk failure. And I decided, you know what, enough is enough. I'm going to set up a mirrored configuration this time, being, 2010 and all. so I'm going to try this ZFS thing that people have been talking about. It looks interesting. I did the ZFS en route thing. If I was going to have this sort of pooled configuration to have the entire disk be available to me as free space, I wanted the whole friggin' disk, right? I wanted the whole thing. So I didn't want to have boot be on UFS and then have to manage where you draw the line between there, so you're either wasting some space here. I suppose, I could have just said to myself, well, you're buying terabyte disks anyway, so who cares? But, this is the efficiency thing. So the whole disk being a UFS tank, and of course you have to buy two to have it a mirrored configuration. So if one of them dies, then the disaster recovery scheme is that when one of them dies, you plug the other one in. and that can be done. ZFS en route is not supported by sysinstall. Now, the talk that's, I think, not in this room but across the hall after ours is going to talk about replacing sysinstall. So yeah, so that is near and dear to my heart. They really probably, hopefully at least, will end up supporting ZFS-based root installs when you do that. Meanwhile, there is on the FreeBSD wiki, and I have the URL at the end of the slides, and there's also a page of links that they had presenters fill in for their talks that I imagine will become public after the talk is over that should have links to those wiki pages as well that has the whole procedure for how you can install a root on ZFS system. And then, you know, once you do that, what I did when I was migrating is I had one of the disks be the original UFS disk, and then I had ZFS on the other one, got it migrated over to where I liked it and got it happy booting on this other disk, and then wiped out the UFS disk and made it into a mirror and resilvered the mirror, and it became, you know, a mirrored configuration. So that's all well and good. When you're doing the wiki thing, I like skimmed through the procedure and said, oh, yeah, yeah, I recognize. I see what they're trying to do here. Yeah. And I skipped the step of copying the zpool.cache file onto the ZFS root partition, which is very important. The machine will not boot if it doesn't find the zpool.cache file at the exact right location on the disk that you have declared is your root-bearing ZFS partition. It won't work. So don't skip that step. And we'll talk more about the zpool.cache file later on as well. ZFS, as I shortly discovered, requires lots and lots of kernel memory. And remember that particular fact when we start talking about VPS later on. The other thing that's kind of striking about ZFS is it doesn't really have any recovery tools, per se. There's no FSCK for ZFS. There's no iCheck or dCheck, and none of that stuff. And you read the FAQ that they talk about, you know, why don't you guys have FSCK? And they say, well, you know, we've never had any problems like that with ZFS. Yeah, and no HAL 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information either. But they do have a point in that they go on to say that, you know, FSCK, if it was necessary, it would mean that there was a bug in the file system code. If there was a bug in the file system code, we'd fix the bug. So one can kind of see where they're going with that. They'd rather fix the bugs and not make a tool that nobody would ever actually need. At the same time, they do have this notion in ZFS of periodically doing a sweep of the disk. What's the word for that? Yes, a scrub of the disk. And the FreeBSD periodic scripts will do a weekly, monthly, whatever you tell it, scrub for you just to make you feel better. So I do that. But of course, the scrub has never done anything but come back and said, yep, everything's fine. So anyway. Yeah, well, it hasn't found any for me anyway. The ZFS benefits, though, are huge. They have snapshots that actually work. For years, I was using snapshots on UFS as part of dump. So, you know, if you're dumping a live file system, you tell it to do a snapshot. So you do that with a regular UFS file system, and it starts saying, yeah, I'm going to dump this volume. And then it waits, and it waits, and it waits. And it locks your system up. It live locks the system while it tries to create the snapshot. And it's always been a problem. And I got to say, the ZFS snapshots are instantaneous. They work. Nothing is interrupted. And it's magic. It's wonderful. Another great thing about ZFS file systems is that they share the common free space of your ZFS tank. The Z pool that you create to have all this stuff live in. you can create them like Kleenex. It's not like NewFS where it has to go and create all the structures on the disk. You tell it to create a file system, and by the time you press enter, it's mounted. It's just there. And you can set all sorts of parameters on these file systems to differentiate one from another. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And like I said, they share the common set of free space. However, you can say that a particular file system has a reservation. That is to say, you want to ensure that there's at least this much free space for that file system to grow into. So you can do that. I've never had a need to do that, but I can see how that would be a useful thing. There's also a quota system where you can say that a particular file system, which might be a home directory for a particular user, can only grow to be so large. So they have quotas and reservations, which are mirror images of each other, kind of, to manage the common pool of free space that's available. But the idea that a file system is like Kleenex, it's like a directory tree, is just liberating, almost. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we do backups for two basic reasons. One is you make a mistake and you have to get back, you have to roll back to what you were doing an hour ago. Or, oh gosh, you know, we've just curdled the disk again. So those are two different scenarios. Snapshots are a perfect strategy for the first one. And I took my cue for a backup strategy from Time Machine. We have hourly snapshots that last for a day and then they get expired, and daily snapshots that last for a week, and then weekly snapshots that last for a month. And as I was developing the scripts to do this, it turns out that someone else did the work for me. There is a port, which is linked to in the references at the end, called ZFSnap. It is a series of periodic scripts that get installed in Use a Local Periodic that will do all that for you. They also will have, they'll add a reboot hook into cron. Their cron, there's a special line in cron that you can add at their advice that will do a cron job when cron starts. So you can do that for when the system comes up from reboot. I don't know why you'd do that with a snapshot here, but you could if you wanted to. And ZFSnap, almost out of the box, does almost exactly what I wanted to. I just had to change. I think I told it that I want my hourly snapshots to last one day rather than 3 days, but you know, that's just an option that you could change in how you set that up. Very, very good work in ZFSnap, I find. But that's not going to help you if your disk explodes. So what do you do about that? Well, one of the things you can do with ZFS snapshots is you can do this ZFS send. ZFS send is the UFS equivalent of dump. It takes a snapshot and writes it out to standard out in a way that there is a matching tool, ZFS receive, that can receive that snapshot and put it back into a ZFS structure for you to read. So that's the mechanism by which you can extract file systems from your ZFS system for off-site archival for disaster recovery. So my strategy for that is to do a ZFS send of the weekly backups, the weekly snapshots on Saturday morning from where my server was. It was in the garage. Now it's in Texas somewhere. To my Mac sitting in my office at home. I was a little bit worried that what I was going to do with this, I was going to use SSH to move the data across. The problem with that is that if you have an SSH public key or a key pair, the private key being on the thing that's sending you the snapshots so that it can get access to the machine that's receiving them, if somebody steals that key, they could do with that key whatever that key had permission to do. That key can't be stored in an encrypted format because cron is going to be doing it, right? We don't want to have to go type the password in at 3 o'clock in the morning on Saturday so that it can do the offsite backups. So the fix for that is that in SSH, the authorized key files, there's an extra slice at the end of the declaration of a public key. Right? No, it's actually at the beginning, where you can say, this key is only allowed to run this command. It's not allowed to open up IP tunnels. It's not allowed to tunnel X. It's not allowed to get a PTY. It's only allowed to run this command, and that's all. And that command for that particular key is what I call shot put. It's a little Perl script. It takes a descriptive line from standard in and then goes all the way up to the first null byte and then takes everything after that and writes it to a file that has that description in it. It sanitizes the description to make sure you can't be smart and funny about anything, you know, like putting slashes in it or stuff like that. And so that's a great way that you can say that that particular machine out there on the cloud is allowed to write new files into this directory but nothing else. And that's fairly good security for doing this sort of remote data shot put thing, kind of. I was going to put a link up to an archive of that script so that you all could share with it, and I have not yet done so. But if I do, I will be sure to put that in the notes. Yes?
If you're worried about the private key being in the player, you could always use the SSH agent. You'd have to type in a passphrase to unlock the agent and load the key, but that's just once. Whenever it's running, you have access.
Right, but then if somebody manages to root the machine that has the SSH agent on it, then they get access to the key anyway. So it's kind of better to lock down the key if you can, I think, and then just leave it unencrypted, because if somebody steals it, all they can do is fill your disk up with crap. Yes?
I've tried doing something like this, and I ran into a lot of headaches with recursive snapshots.
Oh, I don't bother with any of that. I take a snapshot. Well, no, it's of individual file systems.
So you go one by one?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I tried to do it on the board. This doesn't work. There's a bug with receiving some.
Yeah, I just didn't try. I got it working with individual snapshots, and this way also I don't back up all, we'll see in a couple of slides more, I don't back up everything, because not everything needs to be backed up. I just back up the important things. And sure enough, not everything needs to be backed up. I have a PostgreSQL database server on my machine for various purposes, and backing up a live database, it doesn't feel like that would work as well to me. Instead, there's PostgreSQL, when you install the server, it installs some periodic scripts that do database dumps for you on a daily basis. And you could customize that to do it on an hourly basis if you had a more sensitive database or something like that. If you really, really needed to have the database not be interrupted, then you shouldn't be just running one. You should be running a cluster, and they support that in various high-end configurations. That should be the high availability way to do a database. But if you're like me and you're just doing, stupid stuff like the database for your buddy's e-commerce site, and he's selling trinkets out of his garage, then a daily backing up, getting a snapshot of where you do the daily database dumps is just fine. So the PostgreSQL database itself is on a partition that doesn't get backed up. But the dumps are on a partition that gets backed up. I had, for a while, I was scratching my head because the Cyrus IMAP mail partition was larger, I thought. It took up more disk space than I thought it needed to. Turns out that the problem there is that you're writing mail files into the partition, but then you're updating metadata. So the metadata is always needing to be backed up. It's always being touched. And so we had like hourly backups of the metadata database going all the way back in time, and it's just a waste of space because the metadata is useless. You can rebuild the metadata. The worst thing that happens if you lose the metadata is that all of your mail now is unread. It gets the unread flag, so it shows up in bold. Well, that doesn't bother me none. If you had users that were more sensitive to that, then okay, fine. But you could, if in that case, you could take the unread flag file that's part of the Cyrus metadata configuration and move it to a partition that does get backed up. But I just said, okay, we're going to use the meta partition configuration directive in the Cyrus IMAP server and tell it, no, just put all the metadata over there, and we're not going to bother backing that up. We back up all the mail files, but then the mail file partition is a write-only thing. You write the mail file in there once, and you never do anything but read it ever again. So that makes the incremental snapshots work much more efficiently. And then turn off ATIME on root and user, because ATIME means that anytime you access a file, it now has been touched for the purposes of snapshots. So you're going to snapshot all of bin, right? Bad idea. Turn off ATIME, and now your incremental snapshots of root and user are much, much smaller. And, don't snapshot things that you can just download or that you're going to be building dynamically anyway. Just don't bother. I also am swapping on ZFS. So to do that, you create what's called a ZVol, which is just a virtual block device that represents a allocation of contiguous blocks. Well, I guess not contiguous, but an allocation of a large number of blocks in the ZFS pool. You create it. It winds up being a node in slant dev, slant zvol, slant, and then the name of the thing. And you can do whatever you want with it. You can run. You can create a UFS file system on it if you really wanted to. You could, in my case, I swap on it. Unfortunately, the RC scripts have some magic in them that will do ZFS swapping for you. If you set this magic parameter attribute on your zvol, and you then set ZFS enabled to yes in rc.conf, poof, all of a sudden now that will become your swap. And it works pretty well. It's not perfect, though. We'll talk about this in a little bit, but heavy swap usage on swap on ZFS can cause live locks. And that's about all the information I have, because I haven't tried to debug the live locks, because I don't know how. All right. All that was before I was even considering moving off into the cloud. But now, okay, so you've got that going. Now, let's think about, you know, with all the disadvantages we've seen of having a static IP address in your garage, what if you move this out there? Okay, so I picked rootbsd.net. I'll stick in here this caveat that I forgot to put in the slides. I don't work for them. I'm a customer of them, but that's all. That's the only relationship I have with them. They didn't have any input on these slides. They probably don't know I'm doing this. But they're very nice people. Their service works pretty well. So that's who I picked. And sure enough, FreeBSD is actually supported by them. You can have them pre-install for you an 8.2 release 64 or 32-bit VM, and it'll be up and running. They'll email you a pointer to your little admin page that'll have your non-root username and password on it. You can log in with SSH, and away you go. They do not, however, they will not automatically provision for you a ZFS on root system, unfortunately. But you can ask them to provision you a new machine without doing anything. And what they'll do is they'll mount a virtual DVD image, the FreeBSD DVD thing. They'll mount that for you as a virtual CD, and then you can go in and do the thing yourself. So that's what I did. The primary disadvantage of rootBSD, as I've found so far, is they're very stingy with their RAM. For the amount of money you're spending, you don't get much RAM. This is their, I believe, third to highest end configuration. They give you 768 megs of RAM, and that's awfully tight for ZFS. For me, it's working okay, but I can make it live lock without too much trouble, as we'll see. You get 40 gigs of disk. You get 500 gigs of I/O per month. And you get 10 gigabytes of backup disk. Now, what that means is that they'll give you an account on a Linux box that's running on as a DOMU somewhere else on one of their boxes. And they give you two interfaces, two Ethernet interfaces. The public one, which has a publicly routable IP address, which is the one that you use for everything. And they'll give you a second Ethernet interface, a virtual interface on your VM, that is on, if you DHCP, you'll get an address on the 10 net, 10 dot whatever. And if you have multiple VMs, they all can communicate on this 10 net at no charge. So that doesn't count for your I/O allocation if you use that route to communicate between various backend services that you may have on multiple VMs. Additionally, this account that they give you on the Linux box that you can do backups to is on the 10 net as well. So you can SSH into there, and I have another instance of this shotput script running on that machine, so I can actually do on-site backups in a way. And that means that if I had a disaster recovery from losing the VM, but it wasn't that I lost my provider, then I could use the backups there and get to them much faster than having to go across the internet to do it. The other thing is, of course, that I didn't bother with a mirrored configuration because you can sort of assume that your provider will be offering you reliable hardware, right? If not, well, then why are you paying them? So I have some assurance, thin though it may be, that the disk that's under my VM is not going to have block errors under me, right? So that being the case, I didn't bother with a mirrored configuration. I just go ahead and go for it. And besides, even if you did mirror it, you'd be mirroring two virtual drives, right? How do you have any assurance that those aren't on the same physical volume anyway, right? So you get nothing out of it. 500 gigs a month, For me, I'm running a mail server on it. Very low volume web servers, DNS. It's a personal machine, sort of personal domain server for me. And we're doing weekly snapshot backups of the whole thing. And I'm doing about 30 gigs a month. So that's less than a tenth of what their allocation is. The big reason that I've gone to such a large offering of theirs is primarily to get as much RAM as I can afford. And this is $40 every month. They take PayPal. All right. Well, so if you're going to run ZFS in a teeny tiny RAM environment, this is what you got to do. You got to tell it you gets none of your caching area. And so that means that ZFS is not going to be able to cache very much, which means it's going to be doing a lot more work, and it's going to live lock because you're swapping to ZFS as well. But, you know, the live lock is an issue, but it doesn't really happen unless I start doing something wacky. Like every once in a while, I'll rebuild a JDK. That maybe will do it. But for daily operational things, 8.2 release is pretty good. I haven't had much trouble with it. That probably would have been a smarter thing to do in retrospect. I didn't do it because of two things. One, I can recreate the swap anytime I want to with ZFS. I don't have to repartition the disk. And of course, repartitioning the disk is a destructive operation if you're talking about at least making the Z pool any smaller.
Is that something you've found yourself doing more than once?
Well,
resize
to
swap.
You've got a point there.
I was just wondering if there was a particular reason.
I thought it would work better than it would, more or less.
700
yeah.
Even at 2 gigs, I still can.
Well.
On 64-bit.
Yeah, I'm using AMD 64.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it was a bad choice, but it was a choice I made anyway, and I'm sticking with it for now. All the code can do is improve. Let's just put it that way, in my optimistic way. All right, so you paid. Now what? Well, okay. Your console is a VNC server. You VNC into your console, and that you get access to. You can even watch it boot up. You can interrupt it and force it to do a PXE boot if you want to. You can adjust all of the pre-boot stuff. You can get into the loader. You have, like, just as though you're sitting in front of a real PC with a keyboard and mouse and screen. Because it's a VGA console, it's less efficient than using SSH, so you'd only use it for disaster sort of activities, but it is there and it works. You could run X on it even, but if you're going to be using VNC to get into it anyway, you might as well run XVNC. That'd be a lot more efficient than trying to use the console. Since you're going to be using ZFS, if you're going to do like me, you're going to boot up the live DVD and do a manual install with the fix-it thing. So you're going to boot into the live FreeBSD image that's on the CD and then use that for your installation. That'll be part of the procedure you'll see in the link that is at the end of the presentation. I won't go through it now. And you can open up support tickets and have them mount the virtual DVD for you as a recovery tool anytime you need to. There is, of course, a time lag because they have to answer the ticket and actually do it and then power cycle your VM for you. And when you're done, you power cycle the virtual machine, and the DVD is automatically sort of disappears. So my file system layout of choice, what I did anyway, looks kind of like this. And these would have been separate line items, but I ran out of space. But they're all part and parcel. They're all separated because each one has, for some reason, a different set of flags or backup strategies associated with it. User source and user obj could have been linked together, but there's no need to link them together because, like I said before, ZFS file systems are like Kleenex. You just throw them away. Same thing, I suppose, with user ports. But var as a volume does an awful lot of churning in it, so it's going to have a snapshot profile vastly different from home. So it makes sense to separate those. And mount point equals legacy, that's a special flag. That says that for that tank volume, ZFS is not going to attempt to automatically mount that file system. What happens is that when you're booting the loader and the cooperative stuff in the root on ZFS loader will mount the tank, the root of that, on the root file system for you. So you don't have to do that yourself. And if you were to try, it would complain, oh, I've already mounted that. I don't want to do it again. So you don't want to do that. So you make that one mount point equals legacy, and ZFS itself won't try to manage that at all. Okay, and we are using Xen. We have a Xen DOMU, if you want to use Xen's nomenclature for it. I recommend using AMD64. It seems to work the best. And I use just the straight Xen HVM kernel. Well, not quite straight. I've added a couple of things to it, but not a whole lot. and that works pretty well. One problem with that is that the virtual Ethernet interface, ifxn.c, has a bug in it. Whether or not it's a bug in the particular version of Xen that rootBSD is running or whether it's a bug in the driver is open for debate. What happens if you try and do it is you get a panic that says, panic, do something smart. Well, the underlying cause of this is that the virtual Ethernet interface for your VM comes in two pieces, the front end and the back end. The driver looks for a node in the Xen store, and we'll talk about that in a minute, that tells it what the MAC address is. It looks for it on the front end. If it doesn't find it, you get this panic, do something smart. Well, the version of Xen, the configuration of Xen that they're using at rootBSD, puts the MAC address in the back end, not the front end. So the patch is to, if you don't find it in the front end, go look in the back end. If you don't find it in the back end, then panic, do something smart. And that seems to work. There's a PR for that. We'll talk about that at the end. And with that patch, yeah, it's been working just fine. So that does bring up a good point. What do you do when the kernel panics and you've got root on ZFS? Oh, well, shoot. You go into the loader and you unload it, load boot kernel.old and boot minus s. No, that won't work. The problem is that there is some magic in the ZFS support stuff that you load in that automagically loads the zpool.cache file for you. If you unload it, the zpool.cache file goes away if you say unload. And you can't load it again. There's no instruction in the loader to load the zpool.cache file. So you can't load an alternate one. So you can't move it. It always has to be in the same place. I haven't found a good solution for this. What would need to happen is that support for loading the zpool.cache probably ought to be loaded into the loader itself. So the loader should be responsible for loading the zpool.cache and setting up whatever pointers are necessary in the table of stuff that the loader loads so that the ZFS file system can find it in memory when it is trying to start things up. There's a PR for that too. But right now, the zpool.cache file loading is entirely magic. The best that I've been able to do to recover from an unbootable kernel is to unload and set the kernel path variable to boot kernel.old and then just do a boot minus s and pray. I got it to work once. I'm not entirely sure that there were other steps that I'm forgetting to get it to work once because I was in a tizzy, as you can imagine, trying to get the thing going again after I created the panic do something smart kernel. I was like, oh, crap. So I got it working once and then went, anyway, long story. Other things in the kernel. So you start with the Xen HVM kernel. I added a couple of little nuances to it. The Xen man page recommends that you add no adaptive mutexes, no adaptive RW locks, and no adaptive SX. Those aren't actually in the Xen HVM kernel that comes in the distribution, so I added those in my own. It'd probably be a good idea to add those in because the man page actually recommends them. The idea is that on virtualized hardware, you really don't know the state of the physical machine with regards to the things that these things are locking on. So the adaptive part is an optimization. Well, the optimization isn't going to work because you're on virtualized hardware, so just don't bother. Also, the provider recommends setting kern.hz to 100. I haven't investigated that any further. That's just what they did, and I did it. The other thing that I tried to do to work out the live lock situation that wasn't successful in the end was using SW Watchdog and Watchdog D. Watchdog D has saved me a couple of times in the past on dodgy hardware. I'll reboot the machine if it doesn't, if the user land demon doesn't wake up the thing every once in a while, you'll reboot the machine. Unfortunately, in the case of the SW Watchdog, currently all it can do is panic the machine. And the other unfortunate thing is that a live lock isn't enough to make the Watchdog not get petted. So I have to find some other solution or find some command that the Watchdog D can run that will accurately detect a live lock and reboot the machine. But that's TBD. The other one is device polling. I'm not entirely sure if device polling works when you're using the XN interface. Since you're really using a paravirtualized driver at that point, it's unclear whether or not the device polling is implemented. But device polling is nice because instead of interrupting on every packet that's coming in and handling it, you can batch them up effectively. So you're trading some amount of nbuffs for interrupt processing time. So some suggestions. Once you have a machine, and this is really true, this doesn't really enter into whether or not it's a virtual private server or not, but even any server on the internet. If you're going to not put SSH on an alternate port, and if you pick poorly even on some alternate ports, you're going to get SSH Rumpelstiltskin attacks. In other words, your log is going to fill up with, oh, the wrong password for root, wrong password for Oracle, wrong password for sales, wrong password, shut up. So for heaven's sakes, don't use passwords with SSH if you're going to have a server on the internet, especially if you're going to use the SSH normal port 22. Only use keys, and that means turning challenge response authentication to no. What I found is even when you do that, you're still going to get a very noisy log of SSH complaining that people are trying to break in, even though it's not going to work. So I use, there's a port brute block D, or brute block, that will turn the logging volume down anyway. So if you get the thing wrong four times in a row, then IPFW will stick you in a 10-minute timeout. So no packets, you gets none for 10 minutes. It's not really so much that that's going to prevent them from trying to run their stupid little attack, because they'll just wait 10 minutes and try again, but it turns the volume down on the log so that the cron security log isn't quite as long when it mails it to you. That's what I found anyway. And then the other thing that I'm sort of paranoid about, which probably, since I wrote this, turns out not to have been quite as much of an issue, but if I ever were to, like, you know, have my 15 minutes of fame and somebody were to want to get some file on my web server a lot, I don't know, if I created the next YouTube, I guess, I don't know, or something like that, then I'm going to want to make sure that I'm not going to pay for the bandwidth overages that might occur from that. This is a particularly good application for DummyNet. You can say that, all right, HTTP is going to get capped at 1 megabit per second. And 1 megabit per second, I could serve out an entire month and not go over the 500 gigabyte limit. So that works out nicely. And then the other clever thing to do is to just put star in as your root password and use sudo instead. If you need root, use sudo. That way, that's yet another thing that nobody can attack. People, you know, all the Rumpelstiltskin attacks always go for root, so just don't use it. Okay, we know that we're living in a Zen DOMU, so let's look around. When you're using the Zen HVM kernel, you get a Zen store device that you can actually look at and peruse. I promised in the Zen mailing list a couple of months ago that I was going to make the port for the Zen client, which has these Zen store commands in it, and I haven't done that yet. I'm sorry. I'm feeling bad. But I still intend to do that when I have a free moment, probably next week after this conference is over. but we can just take a moment and look around. Yes, good. You can't see that. Whoops. It's tough doing this looking behind your back. Ben?
Yeah, your local is missing out.
Ugh. Oh, Zen Detect. My bad. Yeah, so we're running, this is Zen 3.4, if that means anything to you. I imagine that Zen Store Chmod probably isn't going to do a lot since we're on the client side, but we can do. Zen Store Device. We can look around and see. These are our two Ethernet interfaces, VIF 0 and 1. There's our block device, and the virtual frame buffer, which is our console, paired along with that. We could also look at various really? I'm going to start read. Local, domain, zero, backend. Oh, There's our MAC address. If we did a list up here instead of a read, then it would dump out the things that we can look at, I think. Yeah, that's better. Okay, so we can play around in the Zen Store, and that will come back to us in a couple more slides. Well, in one more slide, actually. So one of the things that I thought, since I'm, you know, a user of this thing and I have lots of feature requests, I have this continuing paranoia about the network usage, that I want to make sure that I never approach the end of that 500 gigabytes a month because I don't know what they're going to charge me. So one thing that would be really cool would be to have some communications between the VPS provider and us. If they're keeping a network odometer somewhere, why not put a copy of it in the Zen Store? Right now, they do have a web page where you can go to and get that information. But the problem with that is that you then are having to do an HTTP request, and you have to put in credentials to do that. And I haven't set that up. And then you'd have to scrape the HTML page that comes back. It's just not very nice. Much better would be able to just do Zen Store read on some node and get back exactly how much network I/O you've done this month, right? And that would persist across reboots and everything, because obviously their odometer has to persist across reboots. So this is an avenue that they could explore if that was practical. I don't know. That would be something they'd have to do on the DOM zero side, of course. But that is something that could be done, is communications between the DOM zero and your DOM U using the Zen Store. That's how that could happen. Another idea is that, okay, so Watchdog is nice, but it panics the machine. If a panic doesn't cause a reboot, and every once in a while I've come across configurations where a panic will panic infinitely, or some other error will happen, and it doesn't actually reboot after it panics, it just sits there looking stupid. It would be awfully nice if there was a way for there to be a Watchdog driver that was aware of Zen, and could, in fact, instead of doing some physical thing, could simply talk to the Zen Store once a minute or whatever the timing is. And if the DOM zero hasn't had that particular communications, then it should power cycle the VM, right? That would be awesome, right? If you could establish a way for the DOM zero to do monitoring like this and use the Zen Store as a way of communicating watchdog activity, that would be particularly useful. But that would be something that would have to happen both on the DOM zero side, that there would have to be support put in Zen for that, and there would have to be support put in the kernel for that. So I imagine we'd have to give that idea to some Linux folks first, because that's what it would take. So What are we left with? What in my ideal universe, what would make my life complete? Well, there is a patch for the Do Something Smart kernel panic with the virtual interface front end not having the MAC address but the back end having it. That patch is in a PR that will be in the references. And it would be nice if somebody were to commit that patch and roll it back to the stable 8 branch. And then 8.3 release would not have that problem anymore. As it is now, every time I run make update, I have to remember to reapply the patch to make sure that I don't build a kernel that's going to panic do something smart, because that would not be doing something smart. That would be doing something stupid. fixing the ZFS live locking would be nice. Barring that, it would be nice if the live lock would actually trigger the watchdog so that the machine would reboot itself and get back to working again. You know, what typically happens when it live locks is I'll get a scream from my wife in the other room, "Nick, the mail's not working again." And I'll SSH into the machine, SSH will hang. I'll bring up the console and it'll be spitting out, "Oh, cannot read block whatever because it's taking too long. Swap pager, read, I don't know, there's a particular message." And I was like, "Oh, great, okay, so reboot the machine." And there it comes back up just fine. The other thing would be to demagicify the zpool cache loading support so that you could actually load alternate kernels and alternate zpool.cache files without histrionics. Right now, if it doesn't work the normal way, then it doesn't work. And that's something that ought to be fixed. And then lastly, being able to do a root on ZFS installation with the installer would be awesome. So that's my to-do list for the community. Yes. So everybody get to work. Why aren't I doing any of this? I hear you. So now we're left with the references. There's ports for ZF snap, root block, and sudo. I'm sure everybody's familiar with sudo, but I had to throw it in there anyway. It's really a good idea. These are the two PRs that have been filed that have been mentioned here. The zpool cache loading one and the X0 panic one actually has a patch included. So all somebody's got to do is commit that patch and roll it back to 8 stable. And then here's some happy URLs. There's more URLs, mostly pointers to the what's it called? The fresh ports links for the ports that have been mentioned. But this in particular is the procedure for running a GPT ZFS root on ZFS installation, how to do it manually. It's not as bad as it sounds, but you just have to follow the instructions step by step. If you don't, you'll have a machine that won't boot, but of course, then all you got to, since you're installing it anyway, you just start over again. And then this was the link to where I found how to tune for a very small memory system. The example given was somebody had a laptop with 768 megs of RAM and had installed ZFS successfully. They probably weren't doing swap on ZFS, which probably is the difference in why the live locks were happening. But that's where we are with that. And then, as I said before, I'm not affiliated with RootBSD except for being a customer. But they're nice folks, I have to say. And with that... Yeah?
Quick question. For the your Postgres directory, what mm-hmm. ZFS attributes do you use?
I use pretty much the defaults for that one, I think. I probably could turn off ATime, but since I'm not making snapshots of it, I don't really care for that. But I pretty much, I think, use the default for that. I'm just not backing it up. Yeah. Wow, nobody else? Oh, well, I'll tell you what we'll do.
Or show me your snapshots.
Sure.
I basically have to give up the arson rule, so.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there's some functions in here to do some helpful work for you, but at the end of the day, we'll start at the bottom. We're going to get the list of snapshots that are for that particular day. And there's a naming. The reason we're doing this stuff, ZFSnap has naming patterns, so that makes it easy to do. And then we're going to go do save on each one of those. Okay, now what's do save do? So we go up a little bit. Do save will do a ZFS send, pipe it into the bzip2, and save it into temp somewhere. That's all you got to do. And then the do send is the thing that does the shot put. And I do two do sends because the one that's laser pointer. Yes. This one here is to the Linux machine that I told you that was the on-site backup, the 10 gigabytes of space. And then this one here is to my house. Home.dyn.kfu.com. I have some magic scripting that does the dynamic DNS thing for the Airport Express that I have that's doing our routing duty for the house. We just send the same file twice. So we do the on-site backup and the off-site backup. And then the do send down here, this is the first part of the shot put. We just echo the name of the backup here, and then we send out a single null byte. There might be an easier way to do this, but it's what I came up with off the cuff, to just send a single zero byte. And then we just cat out the snapshot file and then pipe that into wherever we're sending it. And then this is the special private key that has no permission to do anything but run the shot put command. I can actually show you the shot put command. I have IPv6 going on all this too. Shot put. We read in a buffer here of the first initial bits of it and try and find that first null byte. And then that gives us this name that's part of the file name. And this is where we defang any attempts to send us wacky file names, like, you know, dot, dot, slash, whatever. None of that. and then we also put the time of day on the front of the file name. So that if you tried to do a race condition overwrite of a file that I'm trying to back up, you gets none. And then we get the file name. And then the next thing we do, open it up. Yeah. We write out the rest of the initial buffer that we had read in earlier we were trying to find that first null byte. And then the rest of it is just copying everything we get from standard in into the file. So that, in a nutshell, is our little shot put script. And then we're done. Well, so this is on a Mac. I used to actually unmount the disk when I was done, but now I don't do that because I back up other stuff to it. But so that's the shot put. I don't know. And then the other thing is, I don't think I'm doing any security violations to show you the authorized key file. This is the magic that you do at the front of the authorized key file to say what this key is allowed to do. It's not allowed to do anything, basically, except run that one shot put command. So that's the infrastructure for sending the snapshots from offsite. Did that answer the question, or did you also wanted to see the snapshot stuff?
It's the higher indexing sending the snapshots. Because what I end up snapshotting my root pool and then on the file system, or file, you know,
right.
And you try to transmit the root, it goes, well, fine, but I won't send this file systems. And if you try to send the file systems, it goes, well, the root's not up. You end up, you can tell it to go recursive, but there's a bug in the cement, apparently.
So I would
recommend. It's really confusing, and you can't figure out what the hell's going on.
I would recommend looking at ZFSnap to see about.
I was trying to use. That just does the snapshots, it doesn't do the transmission.
Right. You can see I didn't have any problem. Of course, I'm just doing them all individually.
Yeah, I'm wondering, can you show me ZFS list-dash-dsnap?
Sure. Really? Oh, you're right. All right. So it's...
That's just your root.
Yeah, that's the root. And then each individual one has its own comparable set.
I ended up I think it was
again, my thing is that I'm not actually doing the incrementals. I'm just getting the weekly. And that might be the difference here. It's a full. The weekly is a full. I'm taking the most recent weekly and moving it off-site, and the weekly is all there is. So I'm just asking for the whole thing.
I was also storing to a pool.
Ah.
Maybe that's where I might.
Yeah, again, you have to base your strategy on what your needs are. In my case, my needs are that I need to have disaster recovery down to the week, and if I lose a week's worth of stuff, if the disk blows up or my provider goes bankrupt, okay. And beyond that, I'm using the snapshots in the live system to do backups of stuff that I know disappeared in a hurry, right? And then I can keep the offsite backups going back as far as I want. And go. I can recover to any week in the past, starting from when I made this whole thing go live. Now, at some point, the terabyte disk that I've got is going to fill up, and I'll have to throw the old ones away, but that's a decision that I can make outside of the scope of this. Does that help any?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah, that's just my mail for the most part, and that's not in the bar, obviously. That's going to be up here in home IMAP spool. One of those should be a couple of gigs of stuff, though. Where is it? Is it a weekly? Because I have like over a gig of mail. Oh. No, is it that number over there? Yeah, it's 2.7 gigs of mail. I don't know. I'm not a real expert at reading this stuff yet, unfortunately. I don't know.
Your snapshots are
I guess it's that I don't get very much mail on a going basis. I get a lot of spam, but I throw that away after about a week. Anyway, any other questions? Anybody? Yes. I think I have. Let me just see. What is it? No, it's get all. Oh, no, not that. What did you say was checksum? Yeah, checksum's off.
Yeah, actually.
Yeah, if I were to start building a JDK now, I suspect there's probably about a 1 in 3 chance that we'd live lock the thing. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. When it doesn't, I just reboot the machine and move on, try again. But building a JDK is really about the only thing that I've done that makes it a danger. That's actually high. I'm surprised. Usually it hovers around 40 megabytes of swapped out stuff. There was a script that somebody posted to a mailing list that gives you kernel memory usage statistics. That's what it does, and that's what it gives me on that machine. I could also show you the boot up sequences if anybody's really interested in this. This is what you get from a Zen HVM kernel. It's not a whole lot of interesting stuff. Oh my. Yeah, ZFSnap does a lot of work. Yeah, and the scrubbing, so you can see we've turned on the scrubbing. We told it to do it once a week, which is probably aggressive, but it's relatively low cost so far as I can tell. It doesn't do a lot. Oh, really? Oh, well, maybe I should do that then. I don't know. The only other things that I did for, I've got for the snapshot, I've got the file systems that I want ZFSnap to pay attention to. That really is just filtering out the ones I don't want it to bother with more than anything. And I get ask it for the daily status, which is useless. All it ever says is, yeah, everything's fine. All pool's healthy. All right, fine. And on virtual hardware, you'd expect that, right? If a disk goes bad at the provider, I'm probably never going to even know, right? Because they'll swap it out behind my back, and I'm sure they've got at least a RAID 5 going on underneath me. If not, then they're going to have a lot of angry people someday, but that's... All I can do is assume that they're competent, right? I can't really check because I'm on virtualized hardware. I don't know. Anything more? Yeah, in here? Probably not very. That might be male. Might be. Might be me. You know, it's going to have to read in the Zpool. Well, you'd expect, but again, it can't cache very much, right? Because I have no RAM.
Well, do in front of the one for the dash B.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's, again, because it's virtualized, there's no point in making it a more complicated. Yeah, no mirror, running raw. Very scary. Oh, so the other interesting thing is that you can, you know, one of the things you can do is if you have a copy of VMware Fusion or some other virtualizer for a desktop machine, you can play with this configuration, right? You can set up a VM exactly the same way. And you could, in fact, use that as a disaster recovery system if you wanted to. You could read the snapshots that you've sent off with ZFS send, do a ZFS receive on those on your VMware machine and try that, right? So you can explore that. I tried that to just try and see if I could figure out some way to debug the live locks. Didn't really get very far, mostly because, unfortunately, my life doesn't afford me a whole lot of time to work on FreeBSD, and part of the reason that I've chosen FreeBSD is that it so often just works and doesn't have, you know, a lot of the headaches that come along with other operating systems that I could name. So FreeBSD has served me so well, and I know it so intimately that I've stuck with it. But that, I guess, makes me more of a FreeBSD user than anything else, but I still get my hands dirty once in a while. Anything else? No? Well, either I wasn't very interesting or I answered all your questions. I hope so. Yep.
Ooh, 10 whole minutes to scrub.
It's only a 40 gig drive, right? I mean, it's not that big. And even then, it's half empty. Yeah, actually, I also have this to show. This is a snapshot of the page that you get from RootBSD that shows you what your machine has been up to. The public versus private bandwidth were those two NICs that I was talking about earlier. And so you can see that on the private network, it really doesn't do anything at all. This is probably DHCP, I'm guessing. But, I mean, nothing really goes on the private side. And on the public side, this is just DNS and mail and stuff for KFU.com, which is like a cul-de-sac on the internet. And then these little spikes here are the Cyrus. Cyrus keeps a kind of a cache of text search results. So it's indexing your mail every 10 minutes. Every half hour, or however often that is. So that's what that little spiky activity in the CPU usage is. Otherwise, it would be practically nothing. And then I imagine that's probably the periodic stuff happening at 3 o'clock in the morning every day. Same thing with the disk. So they don't charge you for disk I.O. or anything like that. They just charge you for network I.O. and then charge you your monthly rent on the machine. That's all. Well, since the temporary partition is just the free space on the pool, all I ever have to do is make sure that no one partition ever exceeds half of the available free space. So, yeah, well, but you know, that's the nice thing, you know, the temp, whoops. It's a nice thing. That's the great thing about ZFS and the shared pool space, is that you can do that sort of stuff with it. And of course, did I make temp a separate partition? Yes, I did. I made temp a separate partition, of course, which doesn't get backed up, right? Because why would you do that? So there you go. Anything else? Okay, well, I went over. How'd that happen? All right, well, thank you, everybody.